sing for? All of the youth who seeking the truth and seeing right through their costumes. Who know when the mainstream news crews do interviews, they human cartoons. Just paper thin, ink and imagination, man's creation. More like subliminal training or political campaigning. Hand the nation's opinions daily swaying with justifications of slaves. I wonder why it doesn't coincide with the high rise of the homicides that we facing. Deterioration of education, it takes a backseat.
Welcome to Voices from the Frontline segment of the 4 o'clock Public Affairs Hour on KPFK 90.7 FM in Los Angeles, 98.7 FM in Santa Barbara, and on the web streaming for the world at kpfk.org. My name is Damon Azali Rojas. I'm your host for today. Really happy to be back after a couple weeks gone. We're going to start off our first segment talking about a three-judge panel in California that is going to consider whether or not California should impose a cap on its prison population in order to reduce prison overcrowding. So we'll have critical resistance members Serena Huang and Bob Lane to talk about their push to change sentencing and parole laws and to stop more prison construction. For our second segment, over the last week or so, many of the six, in fact, of the SF8, the eight former Panther either members or supporters who were brought back into trial for a suspected killing of a police officer in 1971, got released on bail. And so we're going to be talking to Ray Boudreau, who is one of the Panther Eight, who is actually here in Los Angeles, has been an activist here for a long time. And finally, for our third segment, we'll be talking to Malcolm Suver of the People's Hurricane Relief Fund in New Orleans. Malcolm will be talking about his candidacy for the New Orleans City Council under a newly formed Reconstruction Party. We'll be right back in a few seconds. Stay tuned.
Remember who you are. My name is Eternal Truth, and those who know will call me Rock. Sela, Sela. I remember who you are. I am Eternal Truth, and my story's written in the stars.
Welcome back. So back in May of this year, the California legislature voted to 53,000 new beds inside the already splitting at the seams prison system of California. And today we have Serena Ring and Bob Lane, who are members of Critical Resistance, to speak about the cap that could be about to be placed on the California prison population. Welcome both of you to the show.
Thank you, Damon.
Hey, Bob. Yeah.
So this has been kind of an ongoing fight in terms of wanting to put more and more and more and more people in prison. I know there have been a couple of bonds that have been floated that didn't actually get support from voters and whatnot. And last May, the Democrat majority legislature in California voted to expand the prison system.
Right.
So, Serena, why don't we start with you? A lot of this is around overcrowding. What does actually overcrowding look like, and why are the prisons overcrowded?
Overcrowding means that prisons are meant to hold a certain number of people, and right now we are at about double that. So, of course, it leads to a lot of problems, a lot of, like, physical overcrowding, it sets up for a lot of, like, prison guard violence from a lot of fights that break out within prisons, and just really, really bad conditions within prisons, worse than they already are. And basically, it's just the way it's always been since we started constructing more and more prisons. The way, especially in California, that we've been growing, when we build prisons, we fill them. So even since, like, 1986, when we started to double the number of prisons we've had in maybe, like, less than a decade, then we've had over 100 years, we've continued to fill them. So AB 900 is actually going to build 53,000 new prison beds. It's going to be the world's largest prison expansion plan in history. It's going to cost us $15 billion, and if we overcrowd those beds at about double, that'll be maybe looking at about 100,000 more people being locked up, which is basically going to double the current prison population.
I mean, it's an interesting thing, because when you're looking, I was doing some research, you know, for my campaign around prison construction. And I know before, I think it was 1984, there were some like 12 prisons that were in the state of California. But since then, there's been 21 that's built. So
right.
Basically about a prison a year. What are, in terms of, just stay with you, Serena, just a little bit more, what are the current numbers that you actually have of who is actually the numbers of people in California prisons right now?
I believe our number is shy of 100,000 right now. And nationwide, it's at about 2 million.
Okay. I'm looking at the, I guess, the amicus brief that you guys put out, and it says, this is kind of in relation to one of the things you were saying in terms of once you build them, you fill them. It says, in the opening of Kern Valley State Prison in Delano 2 on June 2005 exemplifies the phenomenon. In May 2005, there were 163,000 prisoners in California. The Delano 2's new beds were immediately overfilled. By the end of the year, there were 167,000, actually almost 168,000. So this is an increase of almost 5,000 prisoners in 7 months. So as of now, it says right here, 172,971 prisoners as of May 31st, my birthday, of this year. So 53,000 more.
Right. You can only imagine what that number is going to look like and how that's especially going to affect cities like Oakland and L.A. where there's already a really high incarceration rate. Right.
So, Bob, tell us in terms of, I know that also on AB 900, there was the 53,000 beds, but there was also this governor-imposed state of emergency that then actually became permanent, which allowed prisoners to be shipped out of state. Is that part of that number, or is that a separate kind of number of prisoners?
No, the 53,000 beds are just the beds that AB 900 proposes to build. The governor tried to invoke emergency powers to send prisoners out of state and immediately was stopped in that effort by a court injunction. So the state is putting all of its eggs, as it has done time and again over the last two decades, into trying to build its way out of an overcrowding crisis. The overcrowding crisis arose in large part because year after year, the legislature pursued a let's-get-tough-on-crime policy, and they criminalized activity, they lengthened prison sentences for crimes that were already on the books, and they sent people back to prison for technical violations of parole. So this crisis is not a surprise to anyone who's been following this. And it's the result of two decades of neglect by the governors, and the legislature. And this prison expansion program came about because of the threat of the federal courts saying enough is enough and imposing a cap on the population in prison. And it's an effort to head that off. But there's no real reform here. As Serena said, it's just more of the same. In fact, the state's own commission calls AB 900 a part of the status quo. This is not a change, and it's not going to solve anything.
So let's come back to the panel in a second. I know you part of the also in the brief was saying that upwards of 60,000 people per year are being violated for parole and sent back to jail without doing new crimes. And I think the other statistic that I've heard, and I don't know if I have the number right, but Rose Brass, who you know is also with Critical Resistance, was at a workshop one time and saying there has been 1,500 new laws or expansion of laws since the early 80s, which is part of getting folks into the system.
Yes, repeatedly. There have been a series of commissions that the legislature has appointed to look at the problem of prison overcrowding. And time after time after time, those commissions have made recommendations which the legislature has ignored. One of those major recommendations was to reform parole and not send people back to prison for technical violations of parole. The legislature has repeatedly turned its back on that recommendation.
And what are some of those violations that would trigger somebody to get sent back?
Oh, if they don't report in to their parole officer regularly, if they leave the county without permission and don't report their whereabouts, those are the kinds of things. We're not talking about committing a crime. We're not talking about any violation of any law. We're just talking about the kinds of restrictions that go with parole. And that is a big contributor. As a result, there are lots of recommendations that will address the overcrowding crisis. And I think just to amplify on what Serena said, the reason the federal courts are involved is because the overcrowding crisis, they have concluded, violates prisoners' federal rights. So the court that's sitting is going to be very interested in how the state intends to address the problem of the violation of prisoners' rights. And it's, as I said, it's a product of two decades of neglect.
So, Serena, I know that there is the, actually right now, in terms of the California three-judge panel, what are they supposed to determine?
They are actually going to rule on if we should put a cap on the population. If we can put a cap, that would basically be
almost
a moratorium on locking more and more folks up.
So it would actually not allow AB 900 to go through?
It has the potential to do that. We don't really see where that's going to go. And another thing is 53,000 beds is going to take a long time to construct. So that's another reason why AB 900 is not a response to overcrowding, because, for one, it's not an immediate response to overcrowding, aside from the fact that it does not help to reduce prison populations. It also is going to take a long time to construct these 53,000 prisons. So this cap goes through, it could potentially release prisoners, or it would stop more, it would put an end to this construction.
So it would then force parole and sentence reform.
Right.
Okay. So, it's kind of an obvious question, kind of a rhetorical question, kind of a sarcastic question almost, I would say. If we think about the Democrats and on the more liberal, I wouldn't even say left, the more liberal side of the center. Mm-hmm. And that the liberal legislature is the one who passed this. Mm-hmm. And I know that Democrats love to build stuff, freeways, prisons, hospitals, everything else. But what is really, it seems like, it just seems like it doesn't quite, even in the current situation, doesn't quite make sense that a Democrat-led legislature would be spearheading this. So why do you think that is? And I guess the other question would be, knowing the other big force in the state of California around prisons is the Prisons Guard Union. And so where were they in relation to this?
Well, I think the legislature, which was virtually unanimous in passing AB 900, I think the Democrats are always worried that they're going to get outflanked on the tough-on-crime approach.
Tough-on-crime, tough-on-terrorism, tough-on-war.
Exactly, that the Republicans follow. What they're ignoring is that, first, there were two prison construction bond issues put to a vote in the 1990s that were defeated. Proposition 36 was passed in 2000, which provides for treatment for certain classes of drug offenders rather than incarceration. And there are a number of polls that indicate that people don't believe that the tough-on-crime approach is working. The people are way ahead of the legislature on this score. Mm-hmm. They recognize that spending massive amounts of money to build more cells will only add to a system that has failed. It has failed to provide justice, and it has failed to provide safety in the communities.
And I want to add that, and I want to emphasize, actually, that I think this is something that Schwarzenegger and legislators know. They know that we don't want more prisons. They know that the voters don't want more prisons, and that the folks who live in L.A. and Oakland and all over California don't want more prisons. That's why they had to sneak this bill by. They made this deal behind closed doors. Normally, there were no public hearings, there were no public anything, there was no public input. California residents didn't get to vote on this bill. The legislator and the Schwarzenegger decided to put this bill through without any kind of public input by sneaking it through as a lease revenue bond.
The lease revenue bonds. Folks, if you haven't heard about that, you should go to my interview with Ruthie Gilmore earlier this year, where you talked about the whole lease revenue versus general obligation bonds. Lease revenue, you don't have to, they try to go around the whole voters thing. But what I think is interesting, if we look at this on the state level, and then based on LA, county and city, there were two initiatives that were actually trying to get 1,000 more police officers. Both of them failed in terms of the on the ballot. And then they kind of went around and did this whole trash tax, which was around the voters. So it's real interesting to me that both on the city level, in terms of the expansion of the police force, which is the front line, the big net, if you will, to get people into the prison system, on both ways you have sometimes, I would say, quote, unquote, progressive, whichever that means at this point, politicians, particularly Democrats, who are helping this get locked down, you know, in terms of what they're doing and pushing these policies. So what's your response to that?
Well, I think another part of this is that there are very powerful interests that want to see more prisons.
Such as who?
The people who build prisons, the people who supply prisons, and the people who staff prisons. Mm-hmm. Although, interestingly, the Correctional Officers Union filed an amicus brief earlier in the federal court in which they went on record as opposing AB 900. And the reason they did is because they provided all this money to build prisons and nothing
for them
to pay for staffing of the prisons.
Meaning that they'll have to stretch the staffing, or meaning that that's a whole nother bond or...
Well, it's the, you know, it's the correctional guards who have to deal most directly with the overcrowding situation. After the people who are in prisons, it's the members of the correction guards union that has to deal with it. Now, often we're at odds with them because they want different things out of the prison system. But in this instance, they also recognize that AB 900 is making a failed system bigger, and it's not solving anything.
Well, I want to add one more question, and then I know you guys have events coming up, so I want you to be able to say that in the last few minutes here. But I guess my question, I don't know if this was you guys are working with this, or this is part of the article that I read in the LA Times this morning that's around kind of like using disability law against the kind of the prison system in relation to that. Many of the people inside prison and jails in California have mental health issues that they need treatment for, and you have people sleeping on the floor and this and that. Is that part of this, or is that a separate effort?
There's a separate lawsuit in which a federal judge, who is one of the three-judge panel that's going to be hearing this prison cap lawsuit, appointed a receiver. And what that means is that his appointee took over the providing of health services in the California prison system because he found that the state was incapable and unwilling to do it. And I don't know about the specifics about using disability law, but what that means is that the federal courts have now had been forced to step in because, again, the two decades of neglect have created a crisis. And the federal court now supervises the delivery of health services in the prisons. And that receiver has said publicly that AB 900 will make his job more difficult, and it will result in his taking longer to restore adequate health care to people who are in prison. Nobody likes this bill except for the governor and the legislature, and they only passed it to try and head off more federal supervision of the prison system.
Right. Okay, well, got about a minute left, and why don't you tell us what's happening on October 20th? Tell us how to get people can get in touch if they want more information from y'all.
On October 20th, there's a protest at Chowchilla State Prison. You can go to CR's website, criticalresistance.org, and get information there. We're going to have caravans coming from Northern California and coming up from Southern California. And Chowchilla is a very, very small town. It has two of the largest women's prisons in the country. And we're going there both to protest AB 900 and to show our solidarity with the women who are in prison there. And it's going to be a wonderful day. So I hope people will want to join us in this caravan.
And you can also get in touch with us through our office line. That is 510-444-0484 if you're interested incoming. And we also, Critical Resistance is part of a coalition called CURB, California's United for Responsible Budget. And we have a lot more literature if you guys are interested in learning more about AB 900. And we're looking to be able to strategize more strongly around this and mobilize in larger and larger numbers, around 53,000 prison beds.
So again,
and our website there is www.curbprisonspending.org.
And the phone number for Critical Resistance is 510-444-0484. The Labor Community Strategy Center, where I work for, is also part of CURB. So if other people want more information about CURB, definitely check it out. I want to thank both of you, Bob Lane and Serena Huang, for being with us from Critical Resistance. Keep up the good work.
Thanks.
And this is Damon Azali Rojas. This is KPFK 90.7 FM in Los Angeles, 98.7 FM in Santa Barbara. And we'll be right back with Ray Boudreaux, one of the SF8s, after this break. Thanks. Welcome back to Voices from the Front Lines. This is Damon Azali Rojas, and on the phone we have Ray Boudreaux. Ray, welcome to the show.
Thank you.
Thank you. So it's actually good to have you. I mean, we've been following your case since January, and we've had three or four different shows around you guys, and it's good that you're out.
It certainly is.
I'll start with that.
It's good to be out.
So for folks who've missed those shows, Ray is one of the SF8, and they are a group of folks who basically were fighting for, have a lifelong fight for the Black community in terms of expanding rights and whatnot. They were either members or supporters of the Black Panthers. And in 1971, they were brought up on trumped up charges for killing a police officer. Part of that happened with basically they extracted They extracted the testimony in terms of saying through torture, and then basically it was thrown out. And then the beginning of this year, they were all brought back in again. And so over the last week, I think all six of the eight have been released. Is that correct?
That's correct. Six out of eight. Two of the guys are still doing time in New York.
Right. The Herman Bell and Jahlil Muta King, right?
Right. That's right.
So I know a lot of it was this whole thing around they were trying to get you guys for $3 million, $5 million bail.
Well,
what happened over the last week? How did that get reduced?
Our original bail for a couple of us was $5 million. The first judge that we went in front of decided to make the bail even with everybody, so everyone had a $3 million bail. And over the last 8 months, with our legal team and the kinds of motions that we presented and the kinds of affidavits that were presented on our behalf, and the fact that everyone had been on the streets for 35 years working and living in the same place, the judge saw it our way and reduced the bail to where it was manageable. And it took us 2 weeks, but all six of us have bailed out at this point. The last person, Francisco Torres, got out yesterday.
Well, that's interesting because I was...
Friday, I'm sorry.
In terms of the bail, like even now, I mean, maybe it's just because of, you know, my organizer salary here, but in terms of the bails, they range from 200,000 to almost 700,000.
Right.
What's the difference in terms of the different bails for different people?
I think the judge had in mind different areas of culpability, the way we were charged. And he did a different bail for each person, depending on what the culpability of the charges were, as he saw it.
Okay.
And they did. They ranged from 200,000 to 600,000. But overall, you could say that our bail was reduced from $18 million to a little over $2 million.
Much more doable.
Oh, yeah. And we came up with double that amount in real estate. People cobbled together their homes. People we didn't know and still haven't met, some of them at this point, and they did that for us.
Well, I know we were at an event, I think it was in April, at the Southern California Library, and Yusef Omowale, who is the director there, basically said that you were the one who put in the lights and the electricity inside the library.
Yeah, I went to a meeting there once, and it was pretty dim. So I volunteered my services, and they and got them a deal on some lighting from some people that we did business with. And myself and a couple of people, a couple of friends, installed them over time. Matter of fact, I still got some work to do there. I'm glad I'm on my way home.
All right. I'll call Yousef and let him know.
Yeah, please.
So I know actually that day your wife, Phyllis, and your sister, Janice, were there speaking.
Right.
Just give us a little. I know a lot of it is around, you know, being a political prisoner. How is it in jail? Just tell us how it has been to be separated from them and to know that they're also fighting for you.
It's a very moving thing. Not so much the jail, because every one of us had done time, you know, for our convictions. But the fact that my family and my friends came out so hard behind this and, you know, made sacrifices and traveled and you know, tried to visit. And that was true across the board for all of the guys. And for all of us, being around our children, grandchildren, and family for all this time, I mean, of course we missed them. But, you know, there was a time back in the day when you were kind of on your own and support was just voices. Right. We were much younger and we didn't have families like we had today. So that's the biggest difference in my mind and with some of the other guys that I've talked to. Even my granddaughter came to testify on my behalf my bail hearing, and it was very moving. And obviously the judge was impressed because he did give me a bail that I could manage.
How old is your granddaughter?
She's 19. She's a student at ASU.
Okay. So I know your bail got reduced. Did the charges also change, or is it the same charges?
No, same with the charges. Up to this point, since January, all we've really dealt with is bail and discovery, which we haven't gotten yet. Our next court appearance, we made a court appearance today, but it turned out to be a blank, and we set a new date. The next one is October 10th. And we're going for a collateral estoppel, I think it's called, where some of the evidence should be thrown out. And from there, we'll move on to actually dismissing the case for lack of evidence.
How much time have you actually already spent in jail for this already?
Did about 8 months.
8 months, and then you also were, back in the 70s, you were also in
jail. Well, there was something you said earlier I'd like to correct.
Okay.
The crime that we're charged with occurred in September of 71. In September of 73, some of the guys were picked up in New Orleans, and three of them were tortured. And that's where statements about the crime in 71 came to light. In 75, the three guys who were picked up in New Orleans were indicted in San Francisco.
Okay.
The judge threw the case out because the statements had been coerced and obtained through torture. And that's where the case since 1975. And nothing happened again until this year, or 2 years ago, when the grand jury investigation started.
And from what I understand, there are two detectives, Ed Erdelatz?
Erdelatz, that's right.
And Frank McCoy.
Right.
Who... I mean, it seems, listening to what they have done in terms of stalking, it reminds me so much of what Judge Sable did with Mumia Abdul-Jamal and coming out of retirement to put
Absolutely.
Him back on death row. What, you know, how have these two detectives driven this case against you? And if you were inside their heads, what do you think, what is going on? Why are they so keen on the eight of you?
Because it was a case... The ex-police chief of San Francisco, his name is Earl Saunders, has just come out with a new book. Earl Saunders, I'll put it in this perspective, Earl Saunders and Mr. Erdelatz came onto the force about the same time, and they were both golden boys. They were both being groomed to go up the ladder. But the difference was Mr. Saunders came from a poor background, and Erdelatz's father had been a coach for the Raiders. Some of the old-time Raiders. So Erdelatz, they began to move up, and something happened to Erdelatz along the way, and Saunders went on to become the chief, and Erdelatz went on to become a detective. But I think in Erdelatz's case, his motivation is this is a case that's unsolved. A policeman was murdered. He was always involved in anti-Panther Party activities. You know, he was on the special squad, that kind of thing. And to him, I think it's one that's got away. And I think generally that Mr. Ertelatz is just a racist kind of guy, and this is one that he wants very badly before he retires. As a matter of fact, he had been retired, and I think he came back to work.
So that comparison was very true, then, in terms of Judge Szabo. Right.
Yeah, I agree. I mean, you know, sometimes the guy's just got an axe to grind.
Right.
But 2 years ago, the grand jury investigation started, and, of course, we refused to testify. And some of us did 3 or 4 months in jail then until the grand jury expired. And they took him about a year or a little over a year, and finally an indictment came down. Mm-hmm. And the indictments included Jaleel and Herman, who were in prison in New York, Francisco Torres, who had been working in the community in New York, Harold Taylor, who had been working in Florida, Hank Jones and myself in the L.A. area, and Richard Brown and Richard O'Neill in the San Francisco area. Richard O'Neill, by the way, is only charged in the conspiracy and not the murder. Okay. And there was one other brother. We would have been the San Francisco Nine, but he died of cancer in December of last year, and that was John Bowman.
Okay. So, I mean, I think this is a real interesting time in terms of where black people are at. And I think the three things that I think most recently I've been trying to think about is, one, in terms of the right of return of black people to New Orleans.
Mm-hmm.
Two, you know, last week in terms of Gina,
right,
the massive support, you know,
right,
for these young black men who were accused of this crime. And
mm-hmm.
then the SF8. Could you take a minute and kind of put your case in kind of this broader context of where the black liberation movement is right now and where we need to go?
I agree with you on those three points. I was doing, I was in jail here in San Francisco when Katrina happened for the grand jury resisting thing, and the judge jailed us. But I was in jail when Katrina happened, and I only knew about it because I was talking to my wife on the phone every day. There was television or newspapers where I was. And when she began to tell me about it each day, I began to think of it as a kind of a watershed event in class distinction and race distinction, and that maybe from that there would be some kind of an awakening and a new movement. And there are still bits and pieces of that, but all of that takes time. And then when we were arrested in January and the kind of support that we have, not only from the black community, but across a wide spectrum of people of all ages, and even into Europe. I got letters while I was in jail from people in Switzerland and Denmark, that I think that this is a very important time in the peace movement and in the anti-war movement and generally in the human rights movement. The Jena 6 has brought that to fore, where people have actually gone on their first demonstration, you know, young people, students who have no idea. And I don't know. I'll be 65 in November, and so many things that happen historically or in the world today, I analyze, and some of those things I just take for granted. But in being in jail and having to express myself to people and exchange ideas with people, I realize how little people know about recent history of the United States, and sometimes how little they care, or they have a mistaken idea about what's going on. And I think that not through the media, but through public radio, through small local newspapers, and through the kind of things we're doing now, information is getting out to people, and there's a general eye-opening thing that's going on. As Spike Lee says, wake up. And it sounds like that time, you know?
Right.
And we've been discussing these things because we've all been together here the last 3 or 4 days. And the very question you asked me, we've been talking about over the last few days.
And so in terms of the most recent, you know, re-attacker against, you know, you and the other brothers who are in the SF8, I kind of already know the answer to this, but how does this actually affect your resolve in terms of the work that you do, et cetera?
I'm sorry, say that. How did it?
How does it affect your resolve? Does it make you just kind of want to keep going, or does it make it say, like, you know what, because of this larger context, I actually want to do more?
Oh, of course. That's what each one of us agreed to, that we were going to do more. there's a guy on the radio here that does a radio program on KPU. I'm sure you're familiar with that in San Francisco.
Mm-hmm.
I used to be able to listen to him sometimes in jail, and he had an expression where he says, "You're still a freedom fighter, even while you're laying on the couch. I know you just forgot about it, but you're still a freedom fighter." And when it's brought to you, you don't have a lot of choice.
Right.
And we could step back into our lives and go back to what we were doing, but in fact, everyone was doing something more or less to the degree that they did when we were super militants. People were working in the community, working with young people, and sometimes just one-on-one. I'm an electrician, but still, I work with people every day and try to inform people and, you know, be what you would consider a revolutionary, to try to have an open mind. And, you know, that always put me in good stead in everything that I've done. And each one of us has kind of recommitted themselves to the struggle. And through our recommitment, there are other people recommitting themselves. I had someone tell me yesterday that she had always been interested in Richard Brown, who is a well-known community person here in San Francisco. It was like people that he had raised as children. And she said, when I saw Richard Brown on TV in handcuffs, it made me want to do more.
Right.
Because I knew him personally, and it brought out, you know, the will to resist in me. And she was doing spoken word poetry. That's why I got a chance to talk to her. So all in all, I think it's been a very heartwarming experience for everyone, and everyone has recommitted themselves to try to do more.
So this is Voices from the Front Lines, and I'm talking to Ray Boudreau, who is one of the SF8 coming back to L.A. Why not let you go after you tell me what kind of support do you guys still need?
Well, at this point, we still need support for travel expenses and that type of thing. The bail is taken care of, but the people who live on the East Coast and the people who live in L.A. are going to have to travel back and forth for court appearances, and there are printing costs and that kind of thing. So our website is freethesf8.org, and any information that you would want about the case is posted there immediately. And the addresses where you can make a donation are also posted there at freethesf8.org.
And then I know there's also videos there. I saw a video of Hank today. Also, if you have just want to do an email, it's freethesf8, and 8 being the actual number, 8, at riseup.net.
Right,
so
right.
If folks want to get more information, check it out. So, Ray, again, I'm very happy. And I'm sure a lot of people listening are very happy that you are outside of the cage right now.
It's been a great experience. No one ever gets bail on the murder of a policeman, not when they're charged with that. None of our legal team, none of us can remember anything like that. No one else has been able to come up with anything like that. And I think the reason is there simply isn't that much of a case.
Right.
And I'm confident that in due time, in the next few months, you know, that'll be revealed and we'll all be on the streets and we'll have a lot more to say and do at that time.
Okay, Ray Boudreau, SF8, thank you so much for joining us.
And
we'll keep on following what's going on.
And I'll be coming home tomorrow night.
All right. Sounds
okay.
Good. Okay, thanks a lot. And
thank you.
We'll be right back after this break with Malcolm Suber, who is going to be running for New Orleans City Council under a Reconstruction Party platform. We'll be right back.
A long, long time ago, I was told the story. Flowing like liquid through cracked concrete. Fly paper to the wall from the force of the splash. Felt the crash.
Oh no, did it all fall down?
To the ground, heard the sound. Felt the gush of the wind spinning round and around. And I person staying focused, balled up and tossed the mat.
Still on track, imagine that.
Hand clap marks the spot.
Welcome back to Voices from the Front Lines on KPFK 90.7 FM in Los Angeles, 98.7 FM in Santa Barbara, and for folks in New Orleans, kpfk.org. Malcolm Suber, welcome to the show.
Thank you for inviting me.
Yeah. So, Malcolm, I found the news out when I was down in New Orleans a couple weeks ago for the International Tribunal on Hurricanes Katrina and Rita. After 2 years of doing the tireless work in terms of People's Hurricane Relief Fund, what was the thing that actually made you want to run for, or the movement elect you to run for City Council of New Orleans?
Well, basically, what happened is a sitting council member was forced to resign because he was revealed to have accepted a bribe. And the question that confronted our entire movement here is whether or not we were going to accept the same old crowd of Democratic Party politicians running the same old tide program of not helping our people to come back home, whether or not we were going to go with that program, or are we going to challenge this and say that we need to go in a different direction. This, of course, came about at the same time we are having discussions about the Second Survivors Assembly, Reconstruction Assembly, and discussions about the Reconstruction Party. It was decided that we should indeed contest for this election. And we are building a united front around my candidacy. It's very important for us that we contest this election and actually try to build a movement, a Reconstruction movement, behind my campaign.
So then tell us, in terms of the actual Reconstruction, I don't know if it's officially the Reconstruction Party or if it's the Reconstruction Movement platform or whatnot, but tell us, what are you running on? What are you running on for the movement?
Okay, the basic planks of the platform is, of course, first and foremost, is to bring people back home and to have our people participate in Reconstruction with equity and justice. And what that means, of course, is that the government forced our people at gunpoint away from the city and have not provided them with any means to get back home. We are demanding that the government, which exported us, bring us back home and pay for us to get back home. Secondly, and that we need a new social contract in this city. That's the justice part. As I tell people a lot when I go around the country, the hurricane had hit New Orleans way before Katrina got here. Unemployment in the black community was more than 50%. And the biggest industry in the inner city was selling drugs. As a consequence of that, our murder rate in the city is very high. So we are convinced that we have to call for a city that is based upon a living wage for our workers, a city that is union-friendly, rather than being part of the right-to-work atmosphere down here in the South. We want it to be a right to organize city. We also want to reopen the charity hospital. We want to recapture our school system, which was taken from us when we were out of the city. You know that there was a state takeover of our schools, and the union, the teachers union, was decertified and all our teachers fired. So these are some of the things that we are fighting for, in addition to raising the whole issue of the Gulf Coast Employment Public Works Program. We have advocated from the very beginning that the jobs and the monies that are being spent should be spent with the people from the area. We think that people could be trained in the construction trades, which would last for at least the foreseeable future, and give them a steadier income in the future. And therefore, we believe that we should endorse and demand a WPA-type federal public works program to repair not only people's homes, but the infrastructure down here. Our infrastructure was crumbling before the storm. It's even worse now. All over the city, we have low water pressure. Many places we don't even have fire hydrants. So this is the type of thing that are people's issues. And, of course, we are calling for people before profits. We don't want to rebuild a city that would leave behind 150,000 people if we should get hit by a storm again. So these are the issues that we're raising with the voters in the city and saying that you should seriously think, do you want to continue to live in a city that would be so callous as to leave people behind? And we think that answer is no. And if you believe that way, we think you should support my candidacy.
And Malcolm, I know you guys were doing a campaign around the Red Cross. Is there any anything around that in terms of the campaign demands?
Yes, we have called for a public audit of all agencies, social service agencies, which receive funds on behalf of residents of New Orleans and the Gulf Coast. And we want accountability, dollars to demographics. Where did that money go? Where is it now? And as we discovered with the Red Cross, all that money was not spent, and they've decided to create their own program, basically to create another constituency for themselves. And we think that that is not the purpose for which they receive those funds, and that basically down here on the ground, people in the streets have not received this money. Our people are suffering, and we need that money.
Right. So in terms of this actual seat, who are you actually running against? Who's the, because I know it's only what, 20, 25 days, maybe a month away?
27 days.
Of course you have it. So who are you running against?
And they have a sitting city council person. They have a former senator. They have a former council person. And they have a couple of big business types. But there are 13 people in the field. And we are not in this as a protest campaign. We are in it to win it. So we have put together a campaign team, and we are working hard every day, knocking on doors, standing on street corners, getting the word out. And so we're hoping to have a very big turnout. Our basic constituency, of course, is those people who have been in struggle trying to get back home, and those people who are struggling to get back into public housing, those people who are struggling to demand that they get more routes for the buses. All of the public services here have been severely curtailed. People who don't have cars hardly ever get to work on time because the bus service is so irregular. They don't have enough drivers, nor do they have enough buses. So all of these issues must be addressed if we are to have the quality of life that is enticing and will serve to bring people back home. But most importantly, we have to continue to press to the demand that people be made whole, that if you had a home before Katrina, you need a home. If you lost all your possessions in an apartment, you need all your possessions replaced. And people should know that now, 2 years past Katrina, we are still suffering down here. But we think that our candidacy at least brings some hope and some discussion about what needs to be done as we go forward. And the great hope of the Reconstruction Party as well is a rejection of the Democratic and Republican Party and saying that all of us throughout this country should be having discussions about how do we rebuild this society on the basis of equality, on the basis of anti-racism, anti-capitalism, and really build a mass anti-imperialist party that can help to forge our movement and lead us to a better society in the United States.
KPFK listeners, when was the last time you heard somebody running for office that said anti-capitalism, anti-racism? Just even that, let alone anti-imperialism. So I know a lot of what you were talking about in terms of public housing or public transportation, education, and whatnot, a lot of these were the same issues in terms of the international tribunal that you guys helped support coming off the ground. We have about 3 minutes left. In that 3 minutes, can you talk a little bit how you're including at least the preliminary results of, you know, charges of genocide against the U.S. government for all the different things, abuses that they've done? And
yes,
then also tell us how, if folks want to actually help support the campaign, what they can do.
Yes, very much so. We are using the findings of the tribunal to buttress our case basically, human rights in this city are non-existent, and if we continue the current regime, the current political dominance of the Democratic Party, that will continue to be our track. We have a website that people can go to. It's malcolm4citycouncil.com. We, of course, are a people's campaign, and we are not taking contributions from the big capitalist corporations. We are trying to rely on the people to finance our campaign, so we would welcome any contributions whatsoever. We have a PayPal account on our website, so people can, once again, go to Malcolm, M-A-L-C-O-L-M, for City Council, F-O-R, citycouncil.com. And again, thank you for inviting us to share with you this evening. And we've always had tremendous support from the people out in L.A. and in California. And we're really trying to represent what we believe is the best interest for our people as we go forward.
Great. So this is that was Malcolm Suber. He is running for New Orleans City Council on the Reconstruction Party platform. I want to thank you for joining us on the show.
Thank you.
And I'm sure we'll talk soon.
Okay.
All right. Good luck, brother. So that's going to end our show for today. Wanted to thank, besides Malcolm, we want to thank Ray Boudreau, who's of the SF8, as well as Serena Hyung and Bob Lane from Critical Resistance. Today we heard music from Rico Pavón, Grupo Oba Ilu, Company of Prophets, and you're listening to Art Blakey and the Jazz Messengers. You can listen to previous shows of Voices from the Frontlines at www.thestrategycenter.org. We want to thank our producer, Christine Blasdell, as well as D'Angelo Jones, our production assistant, Dehan Song, and Lisa Adler. We will be staying tuned, all of us, for Beneath the Surface with Susie Weissman, who is coming up right here on KPFK 90.7 FM Los Angeles, 98.7 FM Santa Barbara, and worldwide at kpfk.org. Join us next week for another exciting show. Until then, keep the fist up.